Good evening, everyone. My name is Harry Fernhout, and I serve as president here of the King's University College. And we've been blessed, I should say, this year with a partnership with David Goa and the Chester Ronning Center in presenting a number of events over the course of the academic year that have generally been in the area of interfaith dialogue and the experience of Christians and Islamic people in nations other than Canada, and it's been a real delight to have that that partnership and that dialogue. It certainly is great, David, to see the number of people who came out for this event tonight. So welcome to all of you to the King's University College, and I hope and trust that tonight too will provide a really rich exchange. Also want to welcome Professor Ibrahim Abu Rabi, who's the Chair of Islamic Studies at the University of Alberta. And David tells me that you're going to introduce our guest speakers.
Yes,
for the evening.
Thank
so
you.
Turn the floor over to you.
Oh, David is not going to talk.
Okay. Great.
Thank you so much, President.
Mr. President.
Good evening. Assalamu alaikum. My name is Ibrahim Abu Rabi, ECMC Chair of Islamic Studies at the University of Alberta. And I have the pleasure of introducing our guests from Turkey, especially Professor Thomas Michel and Professor David, David is here. He does not need any introduction at all. Before I do that, I would like to talk briefly as a historical introduction about modern Ottoman history and modern Turkish history to situate our discussion, since Professor Thomas is going to talk about Nursi and the Risalat in Nur community in present-day Turkey, and Professor Farazkaya will talk about the current manifestations of the Nur movement in Turkey. I hope that you can hear me. I've been ill for a while because of my voice, but I'll try to yell a bit. As you well know, the modern Ottoman world came to a fall, to an end, roughly around 1923, with the beginning of the modern nation-state of Turkey, the secular nation-state of Turkey. Whereas the Ottoman Empire had, in a sense, ruled in the name of Islam and the Islamic Caliphate. So it had been a continuation of the Islamic political system that began with the Prophet of Islam in the 7th century of the Christian era. But it was a modern continuation. And as an empire, it was very complex and multifaceted. There were Muslims, Jews, and Christians in the Ottoman Empire. On the Christian side, it was not only Armenians. It was the people of the Balkans, Armenians, Greek Orthodox, Catholics, and later on Protestants in the 19th century. And one major facet of what we call Christian-Muslim relations in the late Ottoman world of the 19th century had been Protestant-Ottoman relationships, where the Protestant missions went from England and the New England part of the USA to build academic institutions and hospitals in different parts of the Ottoman Empire, such as the building of the American University in Beirut at the beginning of the 19th century, the American University in Cairo, Roberts College in Istanbul, as well as different academic institutions for men and women in the vast Ottoman world. In addition to all of that, in the 19th century, there had been a major revival of traditional Islamic sciences, of what we call classical Islamic sciences, in reaction to the hegemonic ideas of Europe on the Ottoman Empire. And Bediüzzaman Said Nursi was born in that context in 1877 in the eastern part of the Ottoman Empire. In many ways, he received a traditional Islamic education in the traditional Islamic sciences of philosophy, Quranic exegesis, classical Islamic theology, and so on and so forth. And by the beginning of the 20th century, when he was still a very young man, he became a major mufti, a major alim, a major scholar in the Ottoman world, and he was centered in Istanbul, and it is believed that in 1916 he was one of the five ulama of the Ottoman Empire to issue a fatwa of jihad against the British and the French and the Russians in the First World War, which means that his status had been extremely high in the Ottoman world. But of course, after the defeat of the Ottoman troops in the war, there had been a major transformation in the life of the Ottoman world, in the life of the Ottoman peoples, in the life of the Turkish people. And Bediüzzaman Said Nursi had a major crisis in his own religious and intellectual life. And that's why in literature we make a distinction between what we call in Turkish Eski Said, Old Said, and Yeni Said, New Said. Because the Old Said was a human being, was a person who was a fighter believing in physical jihad against the enemies of Islam, whose major goal had been to preserve the Islamic caliphate of the Ottoman people, as well as to preserve Islam as a central force within that caliphate, as well as to push modernization and democracy within that system. But after the end of the war and the defeat of Ottoman troops, he changed in a dramatic way. His views on jihad and the ummah changed. He did not change the concepts. To him, jihad meant, after 1918, only normative jihad, not physical jihad. The Muslim Ummah to him meant the preservation of Islamic faith in a highly globalized and secular world, because he knew that the age of secularization was dawning on the Muslim world and he had to deal with it by focusing on matters of Islamic faith and not matters of Islamic state. And therefore there had been a substantial change in his own life, especially between 1917 and 1919. And that change in many ways reflected the deep changes and transformations of the Ottoman Empire and the beginning of the modern secular Turkish Republic. And in that context, he wrote what we call the Risalatun Nur, which is a modern Islamic exegesis, what we call in Arabic tafsir of the Holy Quran, that reflected the deep agonies of Muslims, not only in Turkey, but all over the Muslim world. In relation to what we call modernity, aggressive modernity, but above all in relation to the huge and multifaceted Islamic tradition of the past, of 14 centuries of Islamic tradition. Because Nursi never gave up on Islamic tradition. On the contrary, he revisited that tradition with new eyes, with a new light after 1919. And he wanted to reinvent that tradition in order to deal with problems of identity, problems of modernity, of secularism, nationalism, globalization, and all of these essential issues that we as Muslims in the 21st century are still dealing with and wrestling with. And that's why, as a modern theologian, Bediüzzaman Said Nursi has been an immense theologian. But unfortunately in literature, especially in English or European literature, when we look at the Muslim world, we look only at a small country called Saudi Arabia that has 16 million people and 20 million guest workers. We never mention the guest workers. We forget that the large number of Muslims of the world lives in South Asia, between what we call Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kashmir nowadays. And we forget that the Muslim world, the last caliphate of the Muslim world, had been in Turkey. So very often when we speak about modern Islamic intellectual history, we speak about certain major figures, such as the Egyptian Muhammad Abdu, the Iranian Jamaluddin Lavani, the Lebanese Rashid Rida, the Indian Allama Iqbal. But we forget that in Turkey had been going through, or the Ottoman world at the time, before 1923, had been going through major issues by itself. It had produced its own intellectual figures, the most prominent of whom had been Bediüzzaman Said Nursi. So we have to add him to this major plethora of Islamic thinkers and ideologues of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. In this context, I think that what we will benefit from these talks that will be given by Professor Tom Michel, Professor Farskaya, would be to study the relationship between theology, faith, and state in the context of secular nationalism in Turkey between 1923 and the present time. So with this occasion, I'd like to invite Dr. Tom Michel, Father Tom Michel, to come to the podium.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Well, and thank you, Ibrahim, for this good historical situation. the main focus of who I will be talking about, as well as Faris, is Sayyid Nursi, and his Risala in Nur. Risala, of course, is message of light, Risala in Nur. This is a 6,000-page commentary on the Quran that was produced by this Turkish intellectual who died in 1960. It's absolutely true what Ibrahim was saying, that we can divide his life into the earlier Sayyid, the old Sayyid, and the new Sayyid, because Sayyid Nursi himself did it. He used to refer to the old Sayyid, which was his life until he was about 42 years old. He was an activist. He was living in the time of the transition between the Ottoman state and the new Republic of Turkey, traveling all over, back and forth to Istanbul and all over Eastern Anatolia. But then, at about the age of 42, as we heard, he turned to studying more and more the Quran, writing, preparing students, forming a group of students who would reflect on the Quran with him. And out of this came his Quran commentary, the Risale-i-Nur, the message of light. We don't want to think that Sayyid Nursi sat down and wrote this all at one time. This is things that came from different periods of his life that eventually he put together himself, and then with the help of his students, they were reproduced at first by hand. He did not have the permission of the Turkish government to print until the 1950s, I believe it was, and he spent really a lot of his life in prison. The central idea of Sayyid Nursi during this time, say from 1918, 1920 onwards, was he was grappling with the issue of how, as believer, as a Muslim believer, we can confront modernity. He wasn't trying to turn back the clock. He wasn't trying to go back to medieval times. He appreciated modern advances, but what he saw was that God was seemed to be moving gradually farther and farther from the center of people's consciousness, or we should say people were withdrawing more and more from a consciousness of God. And his big concern is how we can put God back at the center of our lives. And so he develops a comprehensive, what we might say, program of spiritual growth that's based on the study of the Quran. And then it's an interesting element to it is it's done communally. It's not only private study of the Quran, but it's people coming together. I'll give you an example. Last week I was in a town in eastern Turkey, and on Tuesday evening we got together 1,000 people. Just a huge number of people in a room, 100 of whom were deaf. So I was the guest, so I was asked to say something, and the person next to me was signing in sign language for the deaf people. And 1,000 men of young, old, mostly young, actually, coming from all walks of life. They do this every week. In the city where I live in Turkey, Ankara, Turkey, there's probably 200 groups that are meeting weekly to study the Quran commentary, the Risale-i-Nur, to discuss it, to hear it explained by a teacher, a hojja, somebody who knows it better. And so this is this is kind of the program that he set up. Now, you might have heard somebody refer to me as his father. I am a Catholic priest. I was in the Vatican for many years in charge of the Office for Relations with Muslims. And in that context, we signed an educational agreement with the theology faculties in Turkey. And in 1986, I went to Turkey and began to teach. And it was through my students, some of whom were students of the Risale-i Nur, that I came to be introduced to Sayyid Nursi. And I have to say very sincerely that I've really learned a lot from Sayyid Nursi. He's somebody very insightful. He takes a very creative approach to teaching, although he's strongly rooted in the Islamic tradition. And so I want to tell you just one or two things that I find very impressive. Already in 1911, Sayyid Nursi was talking about the importance of Muslims being united with the good Christians, those who are following the teachings and the example of Jesus. And he said that the real Muslims, those who are the pious Muslims who are studying the Risale-i Nur, should be united with these people in doing what? In giving to the modern world a common witness of faith. Now, he's not talking about some kind of organizational merger that the two religions should become one, or that either should compromise the elements of their faith. Muslims remain good Muslims, but they form a kind of unity of purpose with the good Christians, the real Christians, and try to show to the world what lives are like when they are truly God-centered. And so this was what he was saying, that we have to have a common witness to the values of peace, the values of justice, the moral values, the values of worship and prayer in our world, and that we do it together. Now, this is especially surprising because Sayyid Nursi was writing at a time when there were many conflicts and really even violent relations between Christian groups and Muslim groups. In Anatolia, where he lived, there were many kinds of Muslims, there were many kinds of Christians. But generally speaking, the Turks, many Turks felt that the enemies were the Greeks on the one hand or the Armenians on the other hand. Sayyid Nursi said, "Your enemies are not any group of Christians. The enemies that we're all facing are common enemies, and we have to realize that." He said there's three basic enemies in the modern world: ignorance, poverty, and disunity. Ignorance we have to combat. How? Through education. Poverty we have to combat. How? Through programs of development and charity. The third, disunity, we have to combat through what today we would call dialogue. In those days he called it unity. We have to combat disunity by unity. Well, he was really one of the first people to do this. This for me is impressive because in 1952 he sent a copy of the Risale-i Nur to the Pope in Rome, to Pope Pius XII, and a nice note with it. And the Pope received it and sent a note back thanking him. This was in 1952, in which he was proposing these ideas to the Pope. I find it very interesting that in 1965, just about 10, 13 years later, in fact, the Catholic Church in its Second Vatican Council, in its document on Islam, it says that even though there have been many conflicts over the years in quarrels between Christians and Muslims, the Second Vatican Council urges all to move beyond these conflicts and work together in four key areas of modern life: peace, social justice, moral values, and true human freedom. These are the same points that Sayyid Nursi had been saying, that Christians and Muslims should work in a united way on. Now, what he was really talking about was what in those days we didn't really have a word for dialogue. But he's talking about a kind of dialogue that's really based in real life, not the sort of kind of airy dialogue that we scholars can sometimes get involved in. Nor is he talking about the sort of tea parties of our religious leaders that sometimes give dialogue kind of a name of being kind of superficial. He's talking about dialogue at the level of shared life, how we live together, what we do, how together we Muslims and we Christians can say to our world what life can be like if God is at the center of it. And I think this is one way that he there's one passage that really I like, that he describes what the kind of student that he's trying to form with the Risale Nur is. He says it's somebody, God is taking the initiative, and God is revealing God's self in three ways. First way is a matter of truth. God is revealing God's word, and the believer responds with faith. God is revealing God's self as loving and lovable, and the believer responds with worship. God is revealing God's self as merciful, and the believer responds with repentance and thanksgiving. Here at this summary, you might say, of what Islamic God-centered living is all about, is something that we Christians would find very understandable. I can remember in the earliest catechism classes that we learned, what is the meaning of human life? What is the meaning of human existence? It's to know, love, and serve God. Very much a parallel to what Sayyid Nursi is saying. So I find myself in Turkey, I spend my time mostly teaching in the in various theology faculties, and I live in the capital city in Ankara. I find it very easy, almost very very natural to be involved with people in the Risale Nur movement, in the Nur movement we call it, because they're already convinced of the value of dialogue, already convinced of the importance of sharing in life and bearing a common witness to God's presence, God's centrality, God's sovereignty in our lives. So with this, I will turn the floor over to Faris, and he will give you some more information about Sayyid Nursi.
Good evening, everybody. Now, actually, Ibrahim and Father Tom left nothing for me, but I would like to say a few words since I am here, and to respect your presence, just give very short, perhaps a sort of biological information about Sayyid Nursi, his physical life. He was born in 1870s, and he was educated where he was born, in East Anatolia. And he had an extraordinary capability of learning that's called photographic memory. He never forget what he learned once. And he memorized about 80 basic books of Islam, Islamic sciences. And he used to read them once or 3 months in order not to forget. He said that these books later on became a ladder for me to reach the sky of Quran, to understand. And these books actually were instrumental for me to understand Quran, how these scholars understood Quran. And around at the turn of the century, he was invited by the governor of Van, called Tahir Pasha. He had also about 7 different languages he could speak. And he used to receive books and journals from Europe, from the West. Said Nursi, by getting information from Tahir Pasha, that Western countries were very much developed, and he was shocked, you know, with the level of educational system of Ottoman state. He thought that with this kind of educational system, Ottoman state will not be able, or Ottoman people will not be able to cope with the present science. And he said to the governor that I think we have to develop a university that physical and religious sciences were taught together. And the governor said to him that, well, you have to go to Istanbul and project present your project to the Ottoman Sultan, Sultan Abdulhamid II. He went to Istanbul in 1907, just a few years before the First World War. And he, unfortunately, he was sent to mental hospital because they said that you are so young, projecting your sort of thing to the Sultan. And after a few years, he went to, in 1911, what Father Tom was saying, to Damascus, because that time Damascus, Istanbul was political headquarters of Ottoman state, but Damascus was cultural and educational center of Ottoman state. And he gave a talk there, it's called Damascus Sermon. And in that Damascus Sermon, actually, he analyzed the Ottoman education and intellectual position of Ottoman state, Ottoman people, and he the sicknesses, and then he presented some remedies. And by coming later on to Istanbul, and First World War broke, and he went to Eastern Anatolia. He was appointed as Mufti during the First World War. And I just put a bracket here because I know that nowadays the case of Armenian is very, you know, controversial and hot subject. And during the First World War, he actually saved several thousands of Armenian children and women, and then he let them, I mean, he safely delivered to the Armenian and Russian authorities, because he was very sensitive. Even during the war, he applied, you know, a law, is saying that we cannot harm children and women and elderly and wounded people. So this is registered, you know, by French, actually, authorities, and we have that documents with us, original documents. And later on, he was captured as capture of war and sent to Russia. Northern Siberia, he spent there about 2.5 years. And in 19, after the Russian revolution, he escaped and he came to Istanbul. When he arrived in Istanbul, Istanbul was that time under the occupation of Western forces. He spent a few years there struggling, encouraging people to come against the Russian authorities. And he was invited by the new Turkish government led by Mustafa Kemal to Ankara. He went to Ankara, but unfortunately he couldn't cope with Ankara because he saw that the new government actually is more enthusiastic, you know, to sweep away all religious facts. He went to Eastern Anatolia again and spent a few years, I think about 3 years, and later on he was captured again by the Ankara government and sent on exile in 1926. He then was on exile, time to time in prison or exile, until he died in 1960. After a few years relaxing in his grave, and his grave also was destroyed by the army after the 1960 coup, and today his body is not known, in an unknown destination. Now, let us flashback. In 1926, when he was exiled to Western Anatolia in a remote town called Barla. Barla in Greek language, Barlais, means a place where unreachable, a remote and unknown place. So there he actually wrote his magnum opus, Quranic commentary, called Risale-i Nur collection. What Father Tom said, Risale-i Nur means, Nur is light, Risale means message, the message of light or message of Quran. So his commentary is not word by word commentary of Quran, but he chosen certain ayats or certain verses from Quran, then he wrote 6,000 pages of his commentary. Now, in what Risale contains, what kind of subjects we can read in Risale-i Nur, I just would like to say, you know, a few of them. For example, basic thing that in Risale Said Nursi aimed to prove the existence and the unity of God. In a way that when you read, you see logically, you follow a pattern. He says that there are three channels that we learn God. One is the revelations, like Bible, Torah, Quran, okay, in general. And the second, the prophets, that they speak to us. And the third one, he says, the book of universe. So he thinks that the universe is itself a book for contemplation, or in Arabic word, tefekkür, to follow the miracles within the universe, within the creation. And then he wrote about proving angels, the spirit. And he wrote a lot about self, in order to teach us, you know, moral values. And the about women, youth, elderly people, about sick people, you know, about sickness, about theodicy, about justice, you know, social justice. All these things are written in Risale-i Nur in a way that when you read, it is, you know, teaching, sort of spiritual taste is in it. Now, in Risale-i Nur, there is a kind of hidden answer, hidden response to the problems coming by globalization as product of French-oriented enlightenment. Because with the enlightenment, they put God away, okay, and they said that you are, you know, yourself is important. don't think about God. See, see what, I mean, what sciences are saying. So Said Nursi, actually what Father Tom said is bringing God back to into our life. How? Intellectually showing us, proving us that God is there, God has created us for such and such purposes, etc. And in Risale-i-Nur, again, we can, everywhere we can feel and taste that we have to respect ourselves, we have to respect God, we have to respect our neighbors, our fellow human beings, we have to respect animals, we have to respect even, you know, dead, you know, things like stones, etc. So people, why? He's driving from Quran a verse saying that everything is worshipping God, even atoms. Can see, you know, the particles, electrons moving around the seed, you know, within the atom, it is, there is an order and there is a purpose. Today we were, you know, while driving here, we were discussing about natural gas stored under the, you know, under underground. So can we say that it is coincidence? It is just like that? Of course not. God has, you know, stored all these things, thinking about us, you know, showing mercy, His mercy, and His compassion towards us, storing petrol, storing gases, etc., etc. So Said Nursi actually teaching all these things and then saying that don't be selfish. Try to share this with your fellow beings and use in a way that don't waste. And these things are sacred, given by God, etc. Now, when we look at Risale-i-Nur, Said Nursi says that the Risale-i-Nur is account of my life, he says. So he's not teaching us, actually. He's teaching himself. And then saying that those who are sensitive, those whose self are sensitive, they can learn along my side, you know. And he's saying that Risale-i-Nur is an account of my life. I didn't write anything that I didn't experience in my life. I found in the Risale-i-Nur remedies for my internal wounds. Those who are looking for spiritual remedies can benefit from Risale-i-Nur. So Risale-i-Nur is instrumental for all of us to keep ourselves spiritually tight, spiritually fixed or fit what God is willing and wishing us to be. And another important aspect in Said Nursi's writing, he teaches his student, and if we read his writings, we are also his student, positive action. Positive action, what Professor Ibrahim Abu Rabi said, that he actually put a cross on physical confrontation or physical jihad. He said physical time of physical jihad is over. If you want to say something or to convince someone, you have to do by words. And he called that jihad manevi. Manevi means spiritual jihad. And he says that before you say anything, you have to live, you have to practice in your life. As English put, action speaks louder than words. So when we follow his life, actually, he is, in his writings also, he addresses himself. He addresses his self first, and then he says that if you are sensitive, you can also read and benefit. In positive action, he said that never criticize others. No criticism. But if you want to say something, put more emphasis on your own views and ideas in order to present and convince others. And another dimension of positive action, there are examples, you know, once they used to eat, you know, eggs in those days, and scrambled with his students in his house. One of his students, you know, he was, Nursi was actually breaking egg, you know, at you know, one edge, and then pouring all what is inside, but leaving the shell unsmashed. One of his students, you know, smashed like that. He said, "Don't do like that. You will get used to destructive habits." And once, you know, a finished fluorescent tube, his student, you know, broke it down. He said, "Don't do like that." He said, "Oh, Ustad, if it's long, I cannot put it in dustbin." He said, "You have to get rid of it very carefully. Don't break it. If you do it, you will get destructive habit." So imagine how much he was sensitive in handling, you know, that sort of issues that affects really our habits. And today, look at the world, how much humanity is suffering because of this, you know, destructive habits. And he was, you know, a pluralistic man. And he was saying that, just in a story, if you do a debate with a friend of you, if in that debate, if you win, means that you lose. Why? Because you don't learn anything. But if you lose, it means that you win. Why? Because you learn something. So, in, you know, this sort of things also, he was teaching us to be ready that, you know, our counterpart may have, you know, truth in it. So he says that everything cannot be absolutely wrong and mistaken. Even a false thing may have truth in it. Be careful. Don't reject it totally. As, for example, he was criticizing, Father Tom, you remember, he was criticizing Europe. He says that Europe are two. One, getting, you know, positive nourishment from Christianity. He said that I don't oppose that Europe, but I oppose the Europe that is inhumane and destroys, you know, spirituality and you know, creates problem and I mean, you understand what I mean. It's difficult for me, you know, like to explain it. So by opposing Europe, he was saying that there are two Europe. One is positive, the other one is negative. So in everything, Nursi wasn't an wholesaler. Okay? He was dividing into two. And as Father Tom said, that he was a very open man for interfaith dialogue. And I would say that he was the first Muslim scholar in modern age to look towards interfaith cooperation with Christianity. He visited Archpatriarch in Istanbul in 1953, and he sent one of his writings book to the Pope of that time, to Vatican. Why? With his words, he said that by this way, by cooperating with pious Christians, we will be able to save humanity from the damages of materialistic atheism and aggressive secularism, where we can see that humanity is suffering a lot. And another point that Father Tom, you know, he said about the enmity, the concept of enmity. his enemy was ignorance. So imagine if a person you don't know, you feel, you know, a bit suspicious about him. But if you sit together, and if while, you know, talking to each other, you may discover some differences. Doesn't matter how much differences you have. If you know him, if you know that you have such and such differences, then you become, you know, you become relaxed. At least you say that, oh, I know that we differ on this subject. So even knowing differences will help you, and that is why he says that our enemy is ignorance, and we have to fight it with education. And of course, byproducts of ignorance are poverty and disunity. And think of how much today humanity is suffering from poverty, and we do not know them. If we know them, if we get rid of our ignorance by knowing them, believe me, I mean, we will ease a lot about the suffering. If we go to Africa, if we go to, you know, Southeast Asia, etc., we have been traveling with Father Tom, and it is really by knowing we help them a lot. And another point that he was, you know, very critical of keeping his students away from politics. This is, you know, a motto by him. I run away from politics as I run away from Satan, he says. So politics, he says, that basically destroys the sincerity. And sincerity for Sayyid Nursi is an important principles that he, you know, sticked a lot, and then he advised his students that you should read at least once a fortnight the Risale of Sincerity. It is in 20th and 21st flush. If you can get by internet, www.nursistudies.com, Flushes book, 20 and 21st Flushes. When you read, you will understand how strongly and how effectively Nursi was practicing sincerity in his life and was advising to his students to follow it and stick it very tightly. I think another point that I would like, and then I will end up my presentation, and I hope that there will be question and answer we can highlight. It is a clarification, actually. We are not here for to convince or to make, you know, others to become Muslim or to follow Sayyid Nursi's views and ideas. But we are here, you know, to know each other. And we invite you also to come to Turkey. Each of you, I will present, I will create an atmosphere. You can explain, you can present what you are thinking, the way, you know, the way of life, and your understanding of the universe, and your respective religious views and ideas. So, actually, Nursi did not urge his students to do missionary work, but to share the truth of Quran, the truth of Revelation, with the other fellow beings, and that's why we are here. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Are you coming here? Father Paul?
Yes.
So this is our internet.
Nursi studies or or com. Both work.
So we'd like to invite you to engage our colleagues to reflect on what they've had to say, or concerns you would like to raise, themes you'd like to raise and hear a little bit more about, and we'll talk together for a little while. Zach?
I just wonder, can anybody bring an example of Nursi's work with the Quran? Reflection on any of his work with any of the verses of the Quran to bring it out?
I didn't understand, sorry.
Like, for example,
can you show what he does with any particular Islamic verse?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, to bring it out from his perspective. Are there any examples of that?
Well, one that might be the case would be the Surah Al-Ikhlas. The
That's the unity.
Right.
Yeah.
He really sees Ikhlas are... We translated it as sincerity, but that's kind of doesn't get the full importance of it. I think better purity of intention. And for Sayyid Nursi, what this means is that everything we do explicitly for God. We do it to serve God. And if we do anything we do to serve God, it can be really unimportant. It can be opening the door for somebody. It's something as simple as that. It is an act of worship. And so he'll take this Islamic concept, and he's written a whole treatise on it. That might be one example. You would have
there are hundreds of thousands of examples. For example, if you can read 25th word, is all about to prove the miraculousness of Quran. Just one thing about Yunus alayhi salam. Yunus, what's in English?
Jonah.
So he was thrown into the sea and swallowed by fish. So if you go to other tafsirs, if you read that case, they will say that Jonah was, you know, faulty. Why? Because he left his ummah. That's why he was thrown to the sea. But Nursi says that all stories in Quran related to prophets are not for them, but are for us. He says that, for example, in the case of, you know, throwing into the sea, sea is this world. Okay? The waves are the incidents of the world. Okay, and our self and our soul is actually fish that going to swallow us. So, yeah, swallowing us. So he said that his fish, you know, was actually destroying his 60 years of age, maximum, but our fish is destroying our eternal life. So he, you know, all explains the, you know, Quranic verses in this way. But I just advise you, you know, to read 25th word and to understand how deep Nursi is in understanding and proving the miraculousness of Quran. And Risale-i-Nur is the only tafsir written in a language which is not Arabic but translated into Arabic. Is the only tafsir. There is no any other commentary on Quran that is written originally in a language other than Arabic, but later on translated into Arabic.
But if I go to this site, I will read it in English.
Yeah.
Not in Arabic.
No, in Arabic.
In Arabic.
If you go to this site,
yeah.
you will get nuronline.com. This is Arabic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yes, all you know Arabic books. There are about 100 Arabic books written on Risale-i Nur. You can download them. It is in PDF file format.
About 2/3 to 3/4 of the Risale-i Nur has been translated into English. And you can find that on the first Nursi studies, the first site.
You can download again.
Yeah.
Around 1,500 papers were presented worldwide.
I have two questions. One is coming to this incident of Prophet Jonah, as the Quran and so many other books of this history, that it happened, there was some wisdom, no doubt, but do you think that it was just a metaphor as you have explained, or it actually happened?
Of course it happened. But the lectures for us is not to study what happened with Jonah, with what happened with Yusuf, Joseph, I mean. But the lecture for us is the second one. Metaphor.
So the real.
Second question is about the Middle East. There are two main sources to know the truth, or to increase in knowledge. One is our thinking and researching. In this, we have confidence, but not in that statement. So, any knowledge that comes from God through revelation is more sure and definite. So, what is the opinion of these who are scholars that is the goal, which is the only means to reach God, or the highway between God and man?
You get the question?
Not exactly.
I didn't know that yet.
Would you repeat the last part of your question?
In short, it is like this.
Yes.
That these days, the door of revelation is open or closed for everyone.
It's not subject of this meeting.
The door of revelation.
It's not subject of. But the door of revelation is closed, but it is not the subject of this meeting. Tonight's meeting. According to Said Nursi, the door of revelation is closed. Because final prophet came, Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, according to him.
But of course, the great challenge is always to understand deeply.
Of course.
And to be engaged by it, and to have your life transformed by it.
Yes, yes.
Revelation is not confined on it. It happens with other people, wise people. They may be prophets, they may not be prophets.
Well, I mean, you may think like that, you know. But we are not here to discuss that. Yeah.
That is what I want.
Yeah. See, the real conviction of Sayyid Nursi was that any kind of change, any kind of social change that is going to take place is going to come about through a personal transformation. So that he's trying to provide people with food for reflection and food for discussion so that this personal transformation will take place and that the Muslim will become a different kind of Muslim, you might say, a God-centered Muslim. That's what he's the whole thing is really about, I'm convinced.
Nursi talked about politics as something to run away from. But our government runs on politics. I mean, we cannot live in a country without politics. So would he have another option for it or another idea?
Now, you see, nowadays and during his time, people were using religion as an instrument to get political power. Okay, he said that religion and sacred Quran and religious matters are so sacred that cannot be instrumental to get political power in that respect. Of course, people can, you know, run political parties, campaigns, and they can do politics, but not under the name of a religion. Because religious matters are so sacred, so high, that cannot be used as an instrument to get political power, first. And secondly, his address was not for ordinary people. His address was to his students. And for religious people, religious piety, he said that you should be away from politics.
Can I answer that in a different
way? Sure.
I mean,
please,
just to complement what Dr. Faris has said, you know, if you look at the modern Turkish history from the beginning of the Republic, 1923 until now, we can distinguish three different phases of Islamic level and Islamic presence in Turkish society. The first one is the government teaching of Islam. Since in Turkey, since 1923, the teaching of Islam has been controlled totally by the state, so that Muslims in Turkey cannot open private schools and universities like this and teach Islam. That is banned in Turkey. So therefore, the Turkish government has controlled the teaching of Islam and consequently has controlled Islamic endowments that the modern Turkey has inherited from the Ottoman Empire. So this is a significant feature of official Islam in Turkey. But the second major feature has been what we call populist movements, and one of which has been the Nur movement, which has opposed the status quo, and that's why for at least 80 years of its first life, it had gone on the defensive because of the power of the state. And the third major movement is the current movement in power, because the current movement in power comes from an Islamic party, Tayyip Erdogan, all of that. They come from the larger Refah Partisi that was established in the 1950s or so. So therefore, we can speak about three different levels or orientations of Islam in Turkey: official, Nur, and political, that is in power. Now, for 80 years, until roughly 10 years ago, Islam had been in a phase of contraction and oppression, whereas today Islam is in a phase of expansion within Turkey, because the government is in the hands of the Islamists. That's very new in the context of modern Turkey, and that is against the will and the grain and the wishes of the secularists and the Kemalists who established the state in the 1920s. So Turkey is going Islamic in a sense, and Muslims are in control of institutions and all of that. That was not the case 10, 20 years ago. And we must remember that Risale-i Nur had been banned officially in Turkey until the 1950s. So if they caught a book or a treatise with you, they would put you in jail. That was against the state. But things are very different nowadays, 50 years or 80 years after the foundation of the Republic in Turkey.
If I may just add my own two cents worth, you will find politicians who are students of the Risale-i Nur. But what Sayyid Nursi, I think, is talking about is, he didn't found any political party, and he didn't ever encourage the students of the Risale-i Nur to act as a political voting bloc or a group that's going to push its own legislation or something like that, to get involved in active party politics. He felt that by doing so, you get into a world where you have to make compromises, where you're tempted to try to use methods and means which are not the good ones. This is the sort of thing he's trying to keep himself, first of all, and his students free from. That's what he means by avoiding politics.
For the purity of the movement.
Yeah.
This would be a kind of critique of the Christian right in America, the way the Christian right functions, using the Christian tradition as a major calling card.
To throw its weight around.
Would be something that would be critiqued. Mark?
Yeah, carrying on that comparison too. I mean, I come from the States originally, and within the Protestantism.
Could you speak a little louder, Martin, so everybody can hear you?
I come from the States originally, and within Protestantism there's always been a strand of Protestantism which has emphasized emphasize Christianity in a very personal way, personal relationship to God, and it's a matter of one's own spiritual life that purified this purity came into the discussion today. And hence, it was politically irrelevant. It never had any political ambitions whatsoever, as well as that strand. There was the strand that David was just mentioning, which wanted to run a definite religious agenda right into the mainstream of politics. And then there was a third strand, which emphasized social justice. It was quite a social justice movement coming at in the 20s and 30s. And that continued for a while. They're dead now. But it was an important strand. And I guess I've got a question here. Does Sight Mercy have any teaching whatsoever with regard to matters of social justice that would make its message relevant to government, even though he encourages his followers to remain apart from political parties and that sort of thing?
Right. Yeah, it's not, you know, when one reads Risale-i-Nur from A to Z, and there is no actually classification of such and such subject. For example, if you read Risale about sick or about elderly, about youth, about women, you will find that spirituality is there, social justice is there, ethic is there, morality is there, the fear of God is there, the existence of God is there. It is a kind of, you know, reflection of Quran. So in that respect, for example, if you go just read, you know, a Risale about Ramadan, month of Ramadan, social justice is there. He's saying that why fasting is ordered by God in order to understand the case of poor people, needy people, to share your wealth with them. Like that. So, very deeply, morality and spirituality is grounded in his writings.
Yeah, I guess what I'm thinking though is does he have any encouragement for people who would want to try to influence the society around them to adopt various practices or make ameliorative arrangements to help the poor and this sort of thing? I mean, is there a kind of interaction with the surrounding society encouraged?
Of course.
Well, it's just a matter of being personally a person who would give to charity and help the poor and this sort of thing.
What's the connection between personal piety, to use kind of North American Christian terms, mm-hmm. personal piety and action on behalf of, and the works of mercy?
He takes up the institution of zakat, for example. He's saying that, why is there conflict between the classes? And he said, basically, because the upper classes are acting selfishly for themselves. They're not concerned about the poorer classes, and the poorer classes are angry and resentful at what the upper classes is doing. He says, and therefore, there is the institution of such as zakat in Islam, which is the tax for the poor. It's not almsgiving. It's something that Muslims must do in an effort to make a more just system in society. And that this is an obligation. It's not a matter of feeling sorry for the poor or something like that. And so he takes the whole institution of zakat and explains it in terms of social justice.
And one thing that he says, that one very short sentence in Turkish is very rhetoric, but in English I can't say. He says that all the fightings of humanity is coming from two words. You know. Number one, you work, I eat, okay. So you work a lot and I eat, you know. I don't work, but I eat, you know. And secondly,
if I am full, doesn't matter whoever dies because of hunger. So these two words. He says the first one is coming from faiz, riba, from interest.
Interest. Because interest on money and principle.
Because in Islam, to gain money with money is illegal. Okay? And the second one, he says that denying paying zakat. So he says that, I mean, these two words are the most problematic, application that created, he said the European Revolution. He says French Revolution. It's coming from there.
If I talk a bit in a more scientific nature, if you look at the economic and social policies of the Kemal state after 1923, that's to say the Turkish economy, there's no doubt that Kemalism produced what we call the welfare state for a number of reasons, but one major reason is that the Turks lost millions of people in World War I. So the Turkish nation had been extremely hurt in the war, and that's why the Kemal state had to respond to that hurt and the occupation of Istanbul by the British and the Russians and the French and so on and so forth. So that was a major instrument for the new Kemal state to focus on what we call social justice, but in secular terms, not caring about Islam or religion at all, because they blamed Islam and religion for all of these immense problems in the war. This is one. Second, because of the total intervention and hegemony of the army after the death of Kemal Atatürk in 1938, the Turkish state was in a major disarray in the 1950s and 60s, and that led to several coup d'etats in the state. And that allowed, in a sense, some major Islamic forces, the Nur people and all that, to focus more and more on social justice and to use that ethic to help the poor in Turkish society. And nowadays, the Islamic party in power focuses on the economy, and that's why it was voted in not only by Muslims but by secular Kemalists, because they had been sick and tired of the state and the intervention of the army in the economic affairs.
Please.
I'm not a theologian, I'm not a academic.
You're here, that's good enough. You're here.
Finish.
That's what counts.
I'm here, and I think to build on the question around social justice, I'm here because I'm representing my family. My husband right now is in Guantanamo Bay with a Muslim Canadian who's being detained, and we look for social justice for him. And I guess I know very little, but from what I've learned in this last hour, I understand Saeed Nursia as teaching a lot about the pillars of a proper society and founded in Turkey. But what does he say that can inform us in this global world and can inform my, like at a personal level, my husband, myself, my two sons, and Omar, our Muslim son, what does his message of life teach us?
Can you comment on it?
I don't know.
Let me say something so that you can comment on my...
Okay.
Faith Nursi sees health as an examination for us. Sickness as an examination. Poverty as an examination. Wealth an examination. Okay. So in that respect, it is an examination for you, sister. You have to stand and you have to take refuge in Allah, in God. So this may improve your spirituality towards God. Because for Said Nursi, when you read his writing in a certain part, he says that time to time I ask myself why I have been jailed, why I have been exiled, why I have been poisoned several times. Later on, I understood that God put these things on me so that myself or my soul is stick to Allah, takes refuge in Allah. Okay. So
I think it's just praying and then taking refuge in Allah.
I think that Risale-i-Nur doesn't give any techniques how you can get Omar released. But I think what it can do is to keep you from getting in despair or discouraged from the failure to succeed in this, or tempted to give up, or resentful towards authority. It can help you to keep on working for the justice in the case of this individual without getting resentful or despairing or feeling failure if you don't succeed, and to keep on going, to keep on trying. And I think that's maybe the most any book or any book of spiritual advice can help us in a situation where we don't have the power to change what we see to be an injustice.
If I could just add one little footnote to that. This matter also illuminates us on our government. It reveals our government to us. It reveals the state in our society as well. And we are called to respond to that out of whatever capacity we have to respond to it. I am so, this particular matter in our nation cuts in such curious ways, because we have a government that was elected a few years ago that was elected in part because of their caring for family, their caring for the lives of children, their caring for marriage, their caring for a whole range of things. That was part of how they positioned themselves and argued. And some of them did it in exactly the way I would argue that Said Nursi said you should never do. That is, they did it under a Christian flag. And so now I sit down with them and I say to them, tell me, my friend, under that Christian flag and under those family values, why, my friend, why are you refusing to even make the most modest petition on behalf of me and on behalf of us, on behalf of our nation, for a child, I would argue, a child brutalized by a father who had become possessed? Now, it seems to me that also needs to be healed.
Sure.
Of course. But it is, I mean, it seems to me, if I've understood you correctly, that this doesn't just illuminate the individual, it illuminates the collective. It illuminates our life together in the world.
Exactly. Yes.
For your information, just to add, 2 days ago, the Vatican's Justice and Peace Commission intervened with the Canadian Embassy to the Holy See about the case of Omar. I do not.
Please.
Thank you very much for sharing with us this message of Said. And this is that we can all appreciate and relate to. What I'm wondering is how or to what extent is this message known and adopted by the entire Islamic community globally? And how does it inform Muslims' view of other religions? To what extent adopted.
Yeah.
How well known is it, and how does it inform the relationship with other relationships?
Yeah, I just, you know, say a few words about it. Our foundation is totally dedicated to organize conferences, seminars, encourage academic works on Said Nursi and his writings. Professor Ibrahim Abu Rabia edited 4 books, and 3 of them came through SUNY Press, State University of New York, and 1 is expected to come in a few months' time by Ashgate, London. And our foundation has organized over 60 national and international conferences and symposia all over the world, starting from Australia. We have been twice or once with you to Australia?
Twice.
For example, 16 international symposiums in Indonesia, Philippines, in most of Middle Eastern countries, European countries, in England, we were together again in England. And there is a publishing house in Cairo called Söz Publication House, publishing Risale in Arabic and books on written on Nursi. And for example, just this year, we are organizing a conference called Young Academic Conference, which will take place in Istanbul 26-27 June, where around 50 postgraduate students who are doing master and PhD degrees on Nursi studies, they will come from Japan, from Canada, from United States, from South Africa, from Indonesia, all over the world. And another conference we are organizing again in 3 to 5 October the pamphlets are here. It's called the Risale-i Nur, Knowledge, Faith, Morality and the Future of Humanity. So far we have received around 300 abstracts, and this conference is not based on invitation. We simply send out, you know, this leaflet, and scholars apply to the symposium. For example, but we are trying our best, but unfortunately Western media is a bit hesitant because they are looking something, you know, some, what they say, if a dog bites a man's, it is not news, but if a man bites dog, it is a big news. Okay? So they are blind, you know, they are blind about Risale, they are deaf about Risale, and they can't speak about Risale.
What about the second half of the question, about the influence of this on the relationship between religions? Is that your?
Yes.
Yeah. Father Tom can respond.
Well, in all of these meetings that we've had, there have been Christians and Muslims offering their insights on the Risale-i Nur. Just last July, we were in the Philippines, which mainly a Christian environment, and then we were in Indonesia, mainly Muslim environment. Again, talking about in both places the Risale-i Nur. One of the really fruitful things that some followers of students of the Risale-i Nur have done have been to organize Abrahamic conferences. I was at a couple of them in Turkey, one in Urfa, Harran, where Abraham may have been from, and the other one in Mardin, in which we had Jews and Christians and Muslims studying together. Now, not necessarily studying the Risale-i Nur together, but inspired by the commitment of Sri Salinur that people of faith should be in communication and giving a common witness to the values of God to our modern world. So it's not just a question of our studying the text together, but of cooperating in issues coming from this encouragement that comes from the text of the Risale Nur. But I'd say at the same time, it's really only at the beginning. Don't forget that for most of the of Sayyid Nursi's lifetime, the Turkish government had him either in prison or in house arrest, and they forbade the publication of the Risale-i Nur. It was just handwritten manuscripts, and it's only in say in the last 50 years that you can have printed copies, and it's even more recent, therefore, that you have any kind of translations into any other languages. Now, English, among the European languages, would have the best set of translations, about, as I said, between two-thirds and three-fourths of the 6,000-page commentary. But in other languages, like in French and Italian, there isn't very much yet that's available.
Dr. Murray.
Thank you. Great presentation, both of you. Two things popped out right away: aggressive secularism and God-centered. I'd like to know if respected Nursi Sahib gave a good definition of what is God or who is God, and that's the biggest challenge we are facing, understanding the reality which is invisible. Mm-hmm. So we could talk about God from the podium, but once it comes to my personal life, I need to know how did he define what in a secular society that what is God.
Yes, but speak out loud so they can all hear you.
From Nursi viewpoint, please, you could talk later on.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Nursi, for Nursi, God is not a physical entity. Okay. Now, God is something. What is a way what we think? Okay.
What we.
Something which is way what we think.
Over.
Yeah.
Ineffable.
Beyond.
Yeah, beyond. Yes, beyond. It is. We cannot. You know. We cannot. We cannot understand God by physical things, physical measurements, and with the words of this universe. Only we can understand. We can know God by God's reflections on the creatures. For example, on a flower. Looking at your hand, your face, and looking at the universe. So we can understand God by God's names and attributes reflected on the creatures. So, and if you are saying that how in a secular society, secular state, we can observe commands of God, can I understand like that? Yeah. Well, I mean, if you are, your hands are,
tight,
okay, and your mouth is tight, your eyes are closed, what to do? You cannot kill yourself. And Nursi says that in that respect, you have to try your best, but you cannot kill yourself, you cannot kill others, okay? And what he did, I mean, his life, long struggle actually, describes how really he lived in a very tight secular society, and he left a 6,000 page of Quranic commentary in that very aggressive secular society. His lifelong, a battle is in front of us. And Ibrahim Abu Rabi has edited a book of him. I mean his life, and published it by Sunni Press.
Can I come to you in a minute?
I really like to hear
Zainab Hadid.
Yes,
just stand
just
up.
One minute.
Yeah. Stand so we can all hear you.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. Please.
I don't want to interrupt. I understand the problems. I do see he reads the universe.
Can you hear?
He knows.
We'd like them to hear.
He's trying to understand what all things that he observes, from the cells to the planets in the sky, how he tries to understand what those things are talking to him. He's trying to understand what those things are telling to him. So he's trying to talk to them and then understand what they try to teach him, what the things they are trying to teach him. So he's trying to understand the loveliness from the cells to the planet in the sky. So he tries to understand the all subjects area from the inside, for example. Biology, chemistry, and math, and other subjects area. So he is trying to understand what those subjects are teaching him. So he is trying to understand, for example, when he looks at this picture, and then he says that, I see that, for example, colors, and then I see that artists made it. Or he is trying to understand the quality and skill in his art. He doesn't know the artist has a beard, artist has a black hair, but he understands the quality and the skills in his art. So this is one perspective that I can
Thank you. I'm sorry that I turned my back.
I got the question from this side.
That's why
I'm very sorry that
Father Tom,
did you want to respond?
No, I wanted to give the
floor
to
Zainab. I'm sorry, I'm apologizing. Please forgive me. I didn't want to turn
there's
my
time.
Back.
Not sure.
You know, it's very simple to answer Dr. Mirza's question. You know, there's a famous hadith saying in the Prophet of Islam, Bada al-Islamu ghariban wa sawfa ya'udu ghariban fatuba lil-ghuraba. Islam began as a stranger in Mecca. It will come back at the end of days as a stranger. So blessed are the strangers. And that's why Sayyid Nursi and Sayyid Nur uses that hadith of the Prophet in a major way, because he himself was a stranger. He was put in prison or under house arrest for 29 years of his life. And that's why he talks a lot about the concept of urba. Urba, that's to say alienation or estrangement from this life. But through alienation, he became very close to the divine and close to God. And that's very clear in his own poetry in Yusatun Nur and his own commentary on the Quran, because he was a stranger. So perhaps all of us are strangers. In quote Alberta as well.
One last question. Raymond, were you?
Well, this is a follow-up to your answer to a previous question. Has there been any response or interest from faith, Hinduism or Buddhism, their scholars, or any group beyond the Abrahamic community? Have there been scholars from?
Sure. Yeah. Yes. Yes, from Buddhism, from Hinduism, like yeah. Nirmal Singh.
Some Sikh.
Nirmal Singh, for example, yeah. Yes. And Jamil Lee from, he compared actually Buddhism with Nursi's studies.
Okay, sure.
I'm just curious how widely Nursi's writings and teachings are known in the wider Muslim community.
In Turkey or in Muslim world?
The Muslim world.
Yeah. Pardon me?
I saw some studies that say maybe there's about 9 million Muslims in Turkey and elsewhere that are coming to these sessions to read the Risale-i Nur together. Other estimates I've seen as many as 12 million. So that's just, I don't know. I can't prove any of that. But somewhere between 9 to 12 million, certainly in Turkey, everybody would have heard about the Risale-i Nur. Everybody.
What about the major Muslim countries where these study circles are?
Yeah. In, for example, I'll just say one example. But before that, the success of Said Nursi's views and idea doesn't lie how widely it is being read and accepted. First thing is, because about sincerity, Nursi says that the acceptance of God comes first. Okay. Not, you know, the acceptance of people. And secondly, for example, in Morocco, high school students are encouraged by their fathers and families, if you pass your high school directly, we will support you to go to Turkey and visit your, you know, dershanes. Dershane where men and women stay, you know, differently, and they do their own profession. They study in chemistry, medicine, physics, or business administration, but they stay in the house. During daytime, they are studying in their respective schools, but in the evening, when they come, they do sort of, you know, what Father Tom said a few minutes ago, they come and they read Risale in a circle, you know, study circle. So their families are sending their children, if they pass, you know, high school, their classes directly, they are given as sort of token to come to Turkey. So imagine how it is widely known in, for example, in Morocco, in Algeria. But I just would like, you know, to correct one thing, that Risale wasn't forbidden, banned until 1952. Risale was banned until 1980 something. No, it became free by Özal. 83 or 84.
85.
Yeah, 84, 85. So I was in the university. I was covering tiny Risale books with, you know, a newspaper and keeping in my pocket and closing Said Nursi's name. When I was studying in the university, and I studied in 1970 something, and it was banned. So, and very recently, we started, you know, in 1990s, organizing this conference and seminars. Today, around over 50 students presently doing master and PhD degree all over the world in different universities. And we are not supporting them. They are doing by themselves.
1986, I was in Ankara. I was interviewed by a group of students of the Risale-i Nur, and they published the interview. It really became kind of an issue. I was called in by the dean, and they said, this is a dangerous group. You shouldn't have been giving them an interview. And so I played the dumb foreigner. I didn't know.
I'm just a Jesuit.
Yeah. And even, you know, he would say, why it is dangerous? The dean would say that it is anti-republicanism. But if you study Said Nursi's life, when he was given soup, he was giving the grain in the soup to the aunts and drinking only the water and saying that these aunts are republican, for their being republican, every aunt is working. I give, you know, the grains to them and I drink only water. So how much Said Nursi was republican, and he's being accused of being, you know, against republicanism. So the republicanism means, in their language, Kemalism. Okay.
Last week I was in a study house, a dershane, in eastern Turkey. There were about 30 students, college students, living there. About 20 of whom are Turkish, but the others, there are about 10 of them, who are Russian, Ukrainian, and from all of Central Asia, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and one Uyghur from China. So it is and two from Afghanistan. So it is an international thing.
Did you? I think we need to bring this. I know he does, but he always has questions. And he's going to get a chance to ask.
David, let
there
him ask.
There are a number of questions.
Let
but
him ask.
We have. Nick?
Mine was just answered.
Okay. So no question is answered.
I know him well.
Excellent. Please go.
It's lovely that to see all of you, and I particularly want to thank both Father Tom and Professor Paris, and also to express my appreciation to the rest of you who have come from Turkey to spend this and the United States, to spend Germany to the United States, to spend this time with us. It's been lovely to have you with us. We appreciate it very much. So thank you so much.
Thank you.